Okay, so before I start, a note on the final. The date of the final is on the schedule. If you can't make the final, there is a form to fill out to take it on a different date. The date of the final is the 13th, I believe, and this is not the final exam time that naturally is scheduled for our lectures because we have two sections. So make sure that that works for you and tell us soon so we can actually accommodate you in some non-ridiculous way. Okay, out of the way, let's go on to today's topic. We're going to move away from performance and talk about some extra features that our processors have, namely exceptions, and something that operating systems implement using this feature called processives. I'm going to start out with some motivational example. So here's a nice simple C program that does very little besides waste a whole lot of CPU time. So let's say I log into one of LabUnix 1 and decide to run this. Are you going to be able to use that machine? So with their model of how a processor works, with the processor you built in the pipe homework, the answer would be no. Your program would never get a chance to run, as long as there was only one core. But if you actually do this, if I actually log into the machine and run this program, and maybe run enough copies of it to have use all the cores, you'll still be able to run things. So that's very nice for a multi-user system, certainly. And it's nice that the same thing doesn't happen when this sort of loop starts appearing in some buggy program you're running. So we're going to look today at how this happens, why this is not going to tie up the whole machine indefinitely. And to look at what happens, let's modify this infinite loop, or almost infinite loop, and just time doing nothing. So with your pipeline processor, if you get the time for here and then do nothing and get the time, you'd expect that to be consistent. You'd expect you to spend the same amount of time because you're just executing the same number of instructions in between fetching the two times. And you expect it to be very, very small all the time, a couple of cycles. Especially since there shouldn't be any reason to access memory in between here, which is the only thing we really know about, which is makes instructions really, really slow. So we'd expect that if when we output these timings, we'd get basically all the same times, so they'd all be very small. So I ran this on a busy system, and this is what the samples look like. So the scale here is in nanoseconds, and it's a log scale. So sometimes things took 10 to the 7 nanoseconds, that's a couple of milliseconds, to execute that little empty piece of code that doesn't do anything and maybe has like an instruction to move the time to a register. So, and we have lots of variation otherwise, even though there's a clear minimum amount of time, which is a little higher than we might expect given how long a cycle is, probably because getting the time takes longer than it should. So what's the cause of these spikes? What's happening there? And the key here is that I was on a busy system. So something else wanted to use the system, and it got to. And this is my sign. So I saw that there was this big gap in time. It looked like I was just running one program and executing instruction by instruction. But for some reason, sometimes one of my instructions took a really, really long time. And this process whereby a machine is shared by making some other program have these big delays is called time multiplexing. So I was running my loop program and I got to use the CPU for a bit of time, and then I didn't get to use the CPU. And the view from me as the person who wrote the loop program is that I was executing some instructions to get the time. I say move the value. And then in between these two instructions, or maybe conceptually while the move queue was executing, there was this million cycle delay. So it looks like I have my own processor here, but my own processor is mysteriously slow sometimes. And the reason that happened is while that million cycle delay was happening, instead of having the processor just the physical processor, just wait there, doing nothing, something ran useful programs that were also on the system. My web browser or my SSH client actually got to use the CPU to do things they wanted to do. And this is sort of the one of the big jobs of operating systems, and this is going to need some processor help. So what my loop program is getting is that it has the illusion that it's running on a processor by itself. That processor just has these funny delays. But other than that, it has its own registers, even though other things are running while it's running. As we say, concurrently, running in the middle of it running. And this notion of a dedicated processor, this abstraction that we give some program something that looks like a dedicated processor, this is called a thread. So you may have seen threads elsewhere, usually talking about running multiple threads. But a thread is basically a notion of a dedicated processor that a program has. And as we see here, that each of these programs has a thread, that doesn't mean that there's one thread per CPU. They can be multiplexed in this way. The operating system can arrange to run multiple threads, just not at exactly the same time, but interleaved with each other. Yes?
If a CPU has, or a processor has multiple cores, can each one of those run its own thread?
Yes, and on each of those cores, something like this will happen. So for today, I'm just going to talk about one core to keep my pictures simpler. But basically, everything that's happening on one core will happen on each of several cores in a multi-core system. And we're going to talk today about how we maintain this illusion of a dedicated processor. And in fact, the illusion is going to be perfect. There is no way for me to tell as a programmer of an application that I don't really have a processor to myself, except for performance. I'm not going to see the values in my registers change. I'm not going to see any effects like that besides the performance indicating that something else must have happened. So this is our conceptual picture here of what gets run. But what actually happens is that there's a little extra thing which has to run. And this is that the operating system runs in between each of these switches of threads. So every time we switch from one thread to the other, we spend a little time running the operating system. And the operating system is going to not have this illusion of a dedicated processor. It's going to know what's really going on, and it's going to arrange to switch between running one of the threads and another. And there's two events we're going to talk about, which happen when the operating system starts running and when the operating system finishes running. So when the operating system starts running, that needs some mechanism supported by the processor, because we aren't running anything in my loop program to do anything special, that gives the operating system control, that sets the program counter to something in the operating system's code. And that's going to be an exception. So an exception is somehow going to happen, and that's going to transfer the PC to run some instructions in the operating system. And those operating system instructions are going to do the work of actually switching what program is on the CPU. Then there's going to be something else with processor support to actually, after the operating system sets up what's not supposed to run on the CPU, to finish the exception and return to running programs in the normal mode for user programs. And we'll talk more today about how that differs from how the operating system runs. Yeah?
So there's dash, the black
and white is in kernel mode? Yes, but we haven't mentioned that yet. It's when the operating system is running. So I'm avoiding mentioning kernel mode at this point, because what I talked about now can be done without that distinction, actually. So other questions, comments? So what the operating system is going to do in each of these transitions is first that somehow the processor with this mechanism called exceptions is going to start running the operating system instead of the normal program, instead of whatever instruction previously run said the PC should be. The processor is going to run the operating system. And the operating system, with cooperation from the processor, is going to need to save what the program was doing somewhere. Because it's not like the processor has an extra place to store that information permanently. So, for example, the old program counter, whatever instruction of the loop I was running, if I was running that move instruction to copy the result of get time, that needs to be put somewhere. So the operating system's going to be responsible for copying that somewhere where it can use it later. And in addition, we need to save all of the registers. So if we look at the code I was interrupting here, the operating system that interrupts this instruction with an exception is going to need to figure out what this program counter value was that points to moveku and save that somewhere. And it's going to need to save the value of RAX and all the other registers. So that later on, when it starts running the program again, this next call will have everything set up so it will work correctly, and eventually we can do this subtract instruction and we'll have all the right values around. And note that the operating system is going to definitely need some help from the processor to do this. The biggest reason is that we need to save the old program counter. If we just set the PC to point in the middle of the operating system, we'd have no way of knowing what that was. So at a minimum, our processor, whenever it does this, whatever this exception mechanism is going to need to put where the user program was running somewhere so we have it for later. Otherwise, we're going to lose that information. So after we save where we were in our old program, we need to start the new program. So in this case, we load information we saved previously to set up the values of the registers and arrange to jump to that new program counter with this return from exception mechanism. And this whole process here is called a context switch. And the name context switch comes because we call the information that we save, all the program counter and all the registers, the program context, or the thread context. So what's in the context is all the register values, all of them, everything that was stored in the processor, the condition codes, and any other sort of special registers that, as a programmer, you could notice the values of, and the program counter, what instruction we're supposed to be running next in this program. So essentially, this is all the state in your CPU, all the state you had in your pipeline processor that ends up being visible to the programmer, except for the memory. So this is all stuff that the operating system is going to need to put somewhere. And at least for the program counter, the operating system is going to need help from the processor to make sure it has that value when it starts running. In practice, the processor might help the operating system with more values, but it's not strictly necessary. You can obviously copy off the registers to memory without having help from the processor. And you can even copy the condition codes by having a whole bunch of conditional jumps. But it would be nice to have an instruction to do that. So what the code in the operating system that executes in that dash portion between running loop and SSH, for example, is going to look like is something like this, that somehow we choose what we were running, the place we're storing what we were running before and what we're running next. and we execute some special instruction to get that saved program counter, the one that we were running just before the operating system ran. And then we just copy all the registers to some saved location. And then we just copy all our previously saved registers from a different thread. And we saved in a different exception. And then somehow jump to the program counter. So what we end up doing is we have stuff in our CPU, and let's say we're running process A. So we're running a thread for some program, and it's going to have some part of memory. And while it's running, the CPU is going to have all these values that we save in the context. It's going to have its condition codes, its program counter, its stack pointer, and all its other registers. And it happens that some of these values point to the program's memory. And we might have some other program that is conceptually also running right now, but isn't actually on the CPU. And this is going to have some space in memory, where its stack is, where its code is, that just isn't being used right now, but it's in memory. And the operating system is going to have a copy of its context, its information that would be on the CPU if it were running. And when we do a context switch, what we're going to do is we're going to swap this saved information with the information in the CPU. So the OS is now going to have a saved copy of process A's stack pointer and program counter. And it's going to put what it previously had saved for process B onto the CPU. So questions about this? Comments? Yeah.
So does the OS have a separate memory, or there's just a portion of memory that's designated?
So for right now, we're going to say that there's just a portion of memory that's dedicated to each of the programs and the OS. We will talk next week a lot about how that actually looks. And we've seen a bit of a preview of that, which gets me to my next topic. So let's say we have two programs here, and I have the value 42 stored in static data in program A, and eventually I copy that to RAX. And let's say while we're doing this work here, I run this program B, and I'm going to take 99, put it in RAX, and then copy that to the same memory address. So if I try to run this on my desktop, what do you think is going to happen? Any guesses? What is a possible outcome? So as a reference, if only program A ran, definitely RAX would end up with the value 42. So first question is, will that change at all? Can program B running actually change that? So who thinks the answer is yes? Yes, program B might change what value ends up in RAX, because it will be context switched to and will run these two instructions. OK, who thinks no, it definitely can't? OK, so most people seem to think that. And who thinks it depends, not sure? Some people. So anyone who thinks that, no, it definitely can't do that, want to defend why? Why? You're just very sure. So yes?
It's because when it's storing stuff in memory, that it's saving the values that it needs for later, and thus it won't overlap. Pulling in and out of memory when it switches between programs?
So your idea is that when we switch between programs, we're switching the memories?
Yeah, like putting values back in memory.
OK, so that's a nice thought, that we are somehow just going to put the memory in the right location. So this picture I have here would be wrong then. And I will tell you that, yes, it is all wrong, but not necessarily in the obvious way. So this would be wrong, in that, in fact, what we do as part of this switch is that we swap the process A and process B memory, because they need memory in the same locations. That would be something that the operating system definitely could do. It could just copy the program's memory to the location where it expects it when it starts running, and then copy it somewhere else. But that would be really slow. So it turns out that that's not what operating systems do. But it is true, in fact, that program B can't actually change what program A gets in RAX. So there's a concept you may have read about today that explains this. So let's first talk about what the answers, results of these programs are named. So for program A, I told you that RAX is going to be 42 always, that this is part of the illusion of a dedicated processor. We're actually going to extend that, and we're going to have the illusion that the program has a dedicated memory. So this program A gets to think that it's the only thing on the machine. It doesn't get interfered with by program B, even though program B is doing something, you know, conceptually with what might be its memory. And program B, well, it might crash. It might not. So you may remember, much earlier in the semester, we showed you this sort of picture of how programs are laid out in memory. That we decided to put the code of the program at a fixed location for every single program, the stack at a fixed location for every single program. And this would be a good reason to think that we must be copying the data around, because how else could we have every program at the same location in memory? And in fact, that's the illusion we actually do maintain. If we have two programs, their image of memory is that they have their data at that location. But doing this by actually copying the data in memory would be way too inefficient. So that's not what actually happens. But we do want to give the programs the illusion that they have their own independent memory. That program A there didn't have to worry about some other thing modifying its global variable. That the information in this writable data here in program A is completely distinct from the information in program B, even if it happens to have the same address. And the way we do that is by having an extra layer of indirection. This is the way we solve all problems in computer science, pretty much. And our layer of indirection here is that there's going to be a mapping set by the operating system. And this creates the illusion that every program has its own memory. So in addition to having its own processor, it appears to have its own independent memory that is independent of every other program on the system, and that it is only used by this program. And this is done by setting a mapping from what the program addresses are, what happens when I put 0x10000 in an assembly instruction in program A, into what real memory addresses that turns into. And we'll talk a lot next week about what that mapping looks like and how it works. For today, we're just going to say that there is some sort of mapping and the OS gets to set it. And as long as the OS makes sure that these mappings don't overlap, there's no problem as far as program B being able to fool around with program A's variables, even if they're stored in memory and not in registers. So questions, comments about concept of this mapping? Yes. Yes.
Okay.
So in this case, the code is at the same place as far as a program address is concerned, but different parts of real memory. So another thing you may have noticed on our picture of how program memory looks is we have these big holes. And I mentioned earlier that if I tried to execute my program B, where I just wrote to this memory address that I just made up, because I happened to know it was the same as program A, that I might get a crash just from trying to do that. And that's because I might be writing to a hole, to one of these holes here. And that's not allowed. And this is another part of that mapping. So in addition to being able to specify this address goes to this part of real memory, the operating system can also say, hey, some addresses you should trigger an error on. If you as a processor need to figure out a real memory address for that, just give up and give control to the operating system with an exception. And this is the cause of the famous segmentation fault you may or may not have run into when doing assignments before. This is precisely that error being triggered. So we'll talk, as I said, next week much more about what the mechanism for this mapping actually looks like in detail beyond this sort of high-level abstraction that we can say that some addresses the program uses are different addresses in the real memory. The name for it is virtual memory. It's virtual memory because the program has this fake view of memory that corresponds to real memory in some operating system chosen way. The mapping is called page tables. And this is going to be part of what we change on the context switch. So if the programs are going to have independent memories, we need to actually swap these two mappings. We need to set which mapping is active. And the operating system is going to need to tell the processor, hey, I want to use the mapping I have set up for loop.exe and not firefox.exe. So that's actually an additional part of the context. So in addition to all our register values, our condition codes, and our program counter, we're going to conceptually change what the memory is. But rather than just copy all the memory of the program to some safe location and copy it back when we start running it, we're just going to change this mapping. And that's going to have the effect of including the memory of the program in its context. And it's going to be a lot cheaper, because we're not actually copying large amounts of memory to change what the address space is. We're just changing what this mapping that the processor is going to use for us whenever the program tries to access a memory address. So when we combine this notion of a thread, that notion of a virtual CPU, with the notion of an address space, which is our virtual memory, we get what we call a process. So a process is just a combination of a thread, or possibly multiple threads, and an address space. And you can think of it as basically a fake dedicated machine. It looks like, as a programmer, that you have a machine to yourself, even though under the hood, some other things might be running on your real machine, both using parts of its memory and using parts of its CPU. But as far as you're concerned, you have access to all the memory that exists, and you have access to all the compute resources that are there of your dedicated machine. And you'll learn way, way more about processes if you take an operating systems course, because that's like most of what operating systems do is deciding how to manage processes. Okay, so I introduced, as part of how we implement switching between processes, this notion of exceptions. So let's talk about what exceptions actually are. So as I mentioned, they're a way for the operating system to start running in the middle of some other program. So it's similar in effect to a function call. Because we start running the operating system, and we remember where we left off. So the operating system can go back there when we switch back to that program. But unlike a function call, there's not a call instruction in the program. We're just running something ordinary, and maybe an exception will happen. And it's not requested necessarily by the program. Well, usually, exceptions are going to switch from a user program to the operating system. And our example from time multiplexing would be that we would want to have the operating system take control of the program at some time. And usually that would be happening from a timer expiring. So the operating system will set up a timer, which conceptually is just a device external to the CPU, which keeps a little counter, and then sends a signal to the CPU. And when that timer expires, this triggers an exception that lets the operating system run and say, hey, I don't want you running anymore because other people need a churn on the CPU. So our book has this sort of taxonomy of types of exceptions. And we've seen two types mentioned so far today. So one was to switch between programs. So how to keep my infinite loop from running forever? And for that, we need something external to the program. There's nothing in my infinite loop code that would actually be a reason to have anything special happen. So there's some externally triggered event, not part of the program. And the typical way that happens is that there's a timer that the OS configures. It decides how long I want to let this thing run before it starts it, before it executes that return from exception. And then make sure that it will get control by that point if nothing else happens. The other very important class of interrupts, these externally triggered events, are from I/O devices. If I press a key on my keyboard, that triggers an interrupt so the OS can run and decide, hey, do I want to start any programs because you pressed a key on your keyboard? Was there anything waiting for that? And it can also process any data from an I/O device. Like from the network. It can figure out what information the network sent to me and where do I put that. So the other kind of exception we alluded to was this case where programs might crash. That if you access memory that's in that hole, that we trigger an error. And the error that we trigger is actually going to be a type of exception because we want to run something and we're not supposed to keep running the program. It wouldn't be very nice if triggering an error meant that we just read some made up value from memory instead of something sensible. So we're actually going to start running the OS and the OS is going to get to decide what to do. So in your experience, if you've ever written a buggy C++ program that accesses memory it's not supposed to, which I assume is a vast majority of the people in this room, you've probably gotten something like a segmentation fault or a general protection error, something like that. That's all the result of what happens when this sort of fault happens from accessing memory not in your address space, and the operating system looked at it and said, okay, I don't know what to do here. I'm just going to kill the program and tell the user I did so. And that's the effect of that operating system decision. That it said, oh, you were accessing memory you weren't supposed to. I don't know what to do with that. I'll just kill the process and tell the user, hey, I couldn't run this. Other classic examples are divide by zero. So often, divide by zero will result in an exception. So the operating system can decide to tell the user, this program divided by zero. Or maybe could do something smarter if there was something smarter to do. And another big example is invalid instructions. If a program runs an instruction it's not supposed to, so in your simulated processor, you set the status code to invalid instruction, which made the simulator stop, but we can't actually just stop the processor that way. That would not be a very good idea just from a point of view of if I run a valid instruction, my whole computer stops. Shouldn't happen. So instead, we trigger an exception and run the operating system. And the operating system decides what to do. Probably it just crashes the program. But maybe it decides to do something else. So the type of fault, which causes your program to crash when you access memory you're not supposed to, is often called a protection fault. There's other types of faults related to memory translation, to that mapping, which we'll talk about next week. But this is sort of the case where we're trying to access memory which is definitely not allocated to us. No, we're not supposed to. And between these two kinds of exceptions, there's a distinction the textbook makes between not only from that taxonomy, but separately from that about how exceptions are triggered. And this is much more universal than that taxonomy. So you'll see lots of places talk about synchronous versus asynchronous exceptions. So our fault is an example where we ran something in our program, and that caused the OS to get control. It was triggered by our program. We didn't request it. We didn't access a memory location thinking, I really want to run the OS here. But it was triggered by a particular instruction. It was caused by executing that instruction. So that's called a synchronous exception, because it was synchronized with our program. There's also asynchronous exceptions, and the only thing in our taxonomy, well, there's two things in our taxonomy which can be asynchronous. The biggest one are interrupts, and these come from outside the program. It doesn't matter what the program was running, but some event triggered it that was unrelated to what the program was running. And this includes like the timer or key presses. It's not part of what the instruction the program was executing. It's not because of a particular instruction. And this distinction is particularly important in operating systems, because how you handle these two kinds of exceptions is very different. If you're handling a synchronous exception, you really care what instruction was just running. If you're handling an asynchronous exception, you probably don't. So, let's look at how our processor is actually going to implement exceptions. So there's three conceptual steps that we absolutely need to do. So one is we need to somehow have logic to detect the condition of the exception. So for an asynchronous exception, we're going to get a signal on a wire somewhere that's unrelated to any of the things you put together for the pipe homework. That's going to detect that external event. For a synchronous exception, we're going to notice something while executing an instruction. We'll talk to the box which represents our memory, and we'll get a signal out saying, this is an error address. We'll do something on our ALU, and we'll get a signal out saying, U divided by zero. So we'll get some signal there in the pipeline and handle it as a side effect of the instruction that now it just, instead of dividing by something, it actually jumps to the operating system. And then however we get that condition, we are going to need to save the PC somewhere. We could save it in the stack, in a special register. I'm not going to commit to a location. I think the simplest thing we could do is save it to a special register and have special instructions to get at it. This is not what x86 does, but that's one option that's sufficient. And then we need to somehow jump to the exception handler. So this is just like a normal jump or a call. We just need to set the PC and start fetching instructions from the operating system. The only difference is that we don't have an instruction we can look at which said to do this necessarily. So when I'm describing exception implementation, I, in the textbook, are describing a somewhat simplified version. I'm going to note that. So there's a lot of extra complication if you look at how this actually works in x86 and 64-bit x86. And most of this is historical. So the biggest issue is that x86 has actually two mechanisms for setting a mapping from program addresses to real addresses. And we only use one of them today, but the other one comes up in how you configure all this stuff. And so there's just this, all this historical baggage, which is relatively unimportant to understanding how exceptions work, but it means that what really happens has a few extra moving pieces that don't really do much and are just things the operating system needs to deal with. But it means if you look this up, you know, in the manual, you'll see all these extra things that are confusing, like linear addresses and code segments and things like that. So in our simplified view, we're going to have a special register in the processor. That's going to tell us where to go on an exception. We need to know where's the operating system code to handle this exception. And this register is going to go to a table of pointers, one for each kind of exception. Because we want to run something different for each kind of exception, it doesn't make sense to just have one place we go. So the operating system is going to set up this table, and for each kind of exception, we'll have an entry in the table, and we'll point to a handler for each of those kinds of exceptions. So we'll have a handler for divide by zero, we'll have a handler for a timer interrupt, and many, many more, since there's going to be lots and lots of kinds of exceptions. And the operating system is going to execute a special instruction that can write to this exception table base register after it sets this up in memory. And when the processor actually needs to run the exception handler, it's going to look at this register, add the number of the kind of exception it has, which is something analogous to the status code you had in your pipeline processor, and then look up that memory location, and then use that result as the new PC. So you can think of it as injecting this jump to exception instruction, conceptually, is how it's going to actually execute that. We're going to insert that into our pipeline, even though we don't have it in our instruction memory. And then after that executes, so we jump to the instruction, we'll start executing one of these handlers set up by the operating system. And it will be these handlers' jobs to do the extra work beyond just saving the program counter. So what the handler is going to do is it has a very consistent structure. Basically, no matter what kind of exception handler it is, the first thing you're going to do is you're going to save the process's state somewhere. Even if you're going to go back to the same process, you need to do this because the operating system needs space to work, needs registers to use, and it needs to do this without making it so the program sees something different happening that destroys its illusion of having a dedicated processor. It would be really weird if, because someone pressed a key on a keyboard, one of the registers in your program changed, even though you didn't do anything to read from the keyboard. So we're going to save the state somewhere. Then we're going to do whatever we do to handle the exception. That's going to depend a lot on what kind of exception it is. Then we're going to restore some process's state. So if it's something like a keyboard event and we want to keep running the same program, we'll just restore the same process's state after handling that keyboard event, say storing the character you write from the keyboard somewhere for later. If it's something where we want to run a different program, like a timer interrupt, we'll choose a new program to run, but the process of restoring the state is going to look the same. We're just restoring it from a different location, a different copy of program of a context in the operating system's memory. And then we're going to jump back to the program. And for reasons, primarily for reasons we'll talk about later, but also because it's really hard to think of how you could jump to a location without changing any registers and have that location to jump to stored somewhere, we're going to have a special instruction to do that, which I'm going to call return from exception. This is not the name of the real x86 instruction, but that's confusing. So we're going to set up the save PC in a special register, and then we have an instruction which jumps using that special register. And using a special register means we don't have to worry about messing up one of the program's registers in order to tell the processor where to jump to. So questions, comments about this picture? So let's look at what we needed to add to our processor to do this. So we added a new instruction. We had this set exception table base instruction. And we also had its corresponding register we needed to add. We had to have this new logic to use that exception table base and actually jump based on it. You have to have this new logic to save the old program counter when we do that jump, either to a special register or to some special location in memory. So the operating system has the program counter to switch to Act 2 later when it decides to run the same process. And we have this new instruction to return from an exception to jump to that safe program counter in a way where we don't have to worry about, you know, using up a register that the program expects us not to change to jump to a location of our choice. So one question that you should know, try to understand, is why can't we just ret? So there's one big reason why we can't do this, which is that this doesn't give us the illusion of a dedicated machine that we want. That, yes, we could write the address to go back to on the program stack, but then the program could tell that an exception happened. This would break the illusion of a dedicated machine in a way other than performance. So we don't want to just use a ret instruction, even though that would conceptually work, to go back from an exception. We're not going to touch the process's stack because that's part of its dedicated machine space. That's something that it thinks it owns entirely and no one else is using that memory. So even though the program is not supposed to write to that part of its stack, as an operating system implementer, we're not going to assume that that happens. We're not going to interfere with any part of the program stack, even if it's above the stack pointer or below the stack pointer if the stack goes down. There's also going to be much more important reasons besides how nice our illusion of a dedicated machine is. Well, we're not going to do this. We'll talk about later. So when we put this together, what we get in our time slicing here is that this particular exception that starts the OS running is actually a timer interrupt. That's the kind of exception it is. And it triggers an exception table lookup. And that eventually starts running this handle timer interrupt instruction. And we alluded to, but didn't show, that we're going to switch address spaces. So we're going to, at the end of this handle timer interrupt, after we've decided, oh, the program I want to run now is SSH, we're going to take all of SSH's registers, restore them to the processor, then we're going to set the address space to whatever the address space of SSH is using some special instruction we'll talk about next time. And we're also going to set the safe PC and then return from exception to start executing SSH.exe. This is what our mechanism actually looks like. And one good question you might have is, well, these are all instructions that set this up. Why can't I run forever if I just set my own exception table? Why can't I just, you know, say, OK, I'm going to write an exception table. Here's my timer interrupt handler. I'm just going to return. I don't want to run a different program. I just want to keep running my infinite loop here. So can I do this? So if this worked, this would seem like, you know, by setting a new exception table, that I actually made timer interrupts do nothing now, because they'll go to this timer interrupt handler, which just goes back to where we started. So we have a timer interrupt while an exceeding jump loop, we'll go back to jump loop without doing anything. So any guesses as to what will happen if I actually write this program and try to run it on, say, my laptop or one of the lab machines? So who thinks that this should work on one of the lab machines? Thinks this definitely shouldn't work. Okay, why not? Yeah, so it'd be really bad if we allowed this to happen. So hopefully this is not something I can actually do, because then I could just run a simple program on one of the lab machines and no one can use it. We certainly do not want that to be possible. So I wrote a program to do this. It turns out that the instruction to just set the exception table. Well, that's the first step here. It turns out the instruction to do that is called LIDT on x86. That stands for Load Interrupt Descriptor Table, for weird historical reasons. I did that, and this is the result I get. I get a segmentation fault. And it's not because I passed a memory address to something that wasn't correct there. No. I just got a segmentation fault. And this is because this LIDT instruction, this set the exception table base pointer instruction, is what is known as a privileged instruction. But only things with privileges can run it. And this is what allows us to safely share those lab machines between users, that we don't have to worry about someone writing a simple program and making it so no one can ever use the machines until they're rebooted. That is a topic for a security course, but we will see that if the operating system does things right, it will not be possible.
It never does things right.
Yes, but if it does everything right, it is actually not possible. So we just can't let any program run some instructions. And some examples are set exception table. We don't want programs to change what the timer interrupt handler does and decide that they control the machine now. We don't want programs to set their address space. We don't want a student to be able to write to another student's program's memory and figure out, copy their code or something from the text editor. That would be really bad. We also aren't going to want normal programs to talk directly to I/O devices. Partly this is because we want to share them between programs, like the hard drive, we want to share between programs. So the operating system is going to want to decide how to talk to the hard drive. And partly because many of the devices can do more things than any one program is allowed to do. Like the hard drive has data on it that not any one user is supposed to access. And to support this, the processor is going to have two modes. One is going to be called kernel mode. And in kernel mode, privileged instructions are going to do what they're supposed to do, normally for the operating system. And there's going to be user mode. And privileged instructions in user mode will just cause an exception to happen instead. Just like our protection fault from accessing memory we're not supposed to, executing the set exception table instruction in user mode will cause a protection fault, saying you weren't in kernel mode, sorry. And the operating system can decide what to do with it. So the implementation here is that we have an extra 1-bit register in our processor, which says, are we in kernel mode? And there's some logic that when we're executing instructions, looks at that register and says, do I want to execute it or do I want to trigger an exception, just based on that register. And we need some way to actually enter kernel mode. It wouldn't be nice if we exited kernel mode and then could never enter it again. Then we could never talk to I/O devices, never change address spaces again. So we need some way to change it. And we don't just want to let users decide, I want to execute my code in kernel mode. That would defeat the point of keeping the user programs from executing these privileged instructions if they just needed to say, pretty please, let me do it. So our mechanism for doing that is going to be exceptions. So when we start executing exception, in addition to jumping to the operating system, we're going to switch kernel mode to on. And when we return from exceptions, conceptually back to a user program, we're going to leave kernel mode. And this is the mechanism, the only mechanism we're going to provide to switch between kernel mode and user mode. So questions about this idea here? So earlier, you may have noticed on our picture of the program memory, we have this region up here labeled used by OS. And one thing we want with exception handlers is that it's not enough that we get to choose what the exception table is and we get to choose what that code is. It's also important that a user program, in addition to not being able to write to memory of other user programs, can't write to the memory of the code which runs the exception in the exception handler, right? It would not be good if instead of changing the exception table, I could just write instructions to the OS's handle timer interrupt and make it just return immediately. So the OS needs some memory where, say, the exception handlers are, and that's going to be in the address space at any given time. But we don't want normal programs to actually be able to change things in that memory. And to support that, we're going to add a little bit extra to our mapping of program memory. That we're going to have part of our mapping is going to point to OS data, but we're going to set a flag in our mapping saying that this map part of the mapping is kernel mode only. So in addition to having instructions like set the address space or set the exception table, we're going to have parts of memory which can only be accessed in kernel mode. So just like the processor was going to give us an exception when we access one of these holes, if you access this part of memory and you're not in kernel mode, you'll get an exception. If you are in kernel mode, you won't. And this lets the operating system not have to change the mapping just to execute an exception handler, but still be protected from user programs and still give user programs the illusion they own the memory without, even though the operating system is using part of it underneath them. So I've told you all about these things you can't do from user programs because they're privileged. But sometimes you actually want to do many of those things. So for example, I told you that talking to I/O devices, that's all privileged instructions. It's not something you as a normal user program can do directly. But clearly, you actually want to talk to I/O devices. You also need to allocate memory. If you want to add more heap to program A, that means changing your address space. And that's a privileged instruction. You want to write files on disk and read files on disk. That's talking to an I/O device. That needs privileged instructions. If you want to just read something from the keyboard, that needs privileged instructions, which means some code needs to run for us in kernel mode. And the way we're going to support that is with the third kind of exception from the textbook's taxonomy, which are traps. So these are intentionally triggered exceptions. And the most common kind are system calls, where we're going to ask the operating system to do something. And usually the reason we're going to ask the operating system to do something is because it's one of these things which needs privileged instructions that we can't do ourselves because our fake dedicated machine doesn't have direct access to that part of the hardware. So on our lab machines, the way system calls work is that there's this special instruction called system call, or syscall, which triggers a trap. That's a deliberate exception. So it's kind of like a call, but in that the instruction executing always triggers an exception, and it's deliberate, unlike our moving to invalid memory or having a timer interrupt happen. And it's what you as a software implementer implementing a program on top of, say, Linux would use in order to request one of those services, one of those things that needs privileged instructions. And a system call on Linux looks very much like a function call. It has a slightly different calling convention. The most notable thing that's different is that Linux uses RAX instead of as a register, which doesn't matter for the calling convention and is clobbered, as the system call number to execute. So there's a list of system calls. Each of them has a number. And before you execute the syscall instruction, instead of passing an address to it, like with the call instruction, you set RAX to indicate which system call you want to use. And then on 64-bit x86, arguments to the system call are passed in registers. For some reason, different registers than normal function call uses, which is a completely arbitrary and stupid decision. But that's what Linux decided to do. And after system call, it's very much like a normal function call. RAX has the return value. And the convention on Linux is that if there's an error, RAX is going to contain -1 times the error number. And otherwise, it's going to contain the normal return value, which varies depending on the system call. But overall, this is almost the same as normal function calls, except instead of having an address of the function, we have a system call number. And instead of executing a function, you know, in the same virtual processor, we use an exception and therefore get to have the function executed on our behalf in kernel mode. So to give an example of what this looks like, here's Hello World written directly against Linux system calls. So 1 is the system call number for the write system call. It takes 3 arguments, the first of which is what is called a file descriptor, which presumably you will learn more about if you take operating systems. And it happens that 1 means standard out, what you would call C out in C++. The second argument is a pointer to a string. And the third argument is the length of the string to write. So we set up the system call number 1 and these arguments, and then call syscall. And that triggers an exception. And when that exception completes, the operating system will return to exception at this move queue instruction. But before that, it will actually do the write, send the information that we requested to the terminal. So this next here system call here is that we move 60, which is the system call number for exit, and 0 as the argument to exit with status code 0, which means that your shell will say that your program didn't fail. And then use syscall. And this system call triggers an exception. And that exception handler is going to stop running our program forever. It's just going to save its state and then get rid of it. And that's what we have to do to actually exit our program, because without that, we're just going to keep executing whatever instructions follow this in memory until something fails. So any questions about this? So this is the user space code. And in the Linux kernel, we have something that handles the system call kind of exception. So it's one of those entries in the exception table. It's going to point to this handle syscall piece of assembly. And it's going to do that same procedure we had before. We're going to save the state of the program so the kernel has space to work, including all the registers. Then we're going to use another table of which types of system call there is and choose which one to call based on the value of RAX, our system call number. And then when we're done with that, we're going to restore our state just like with a normal function call and then return from exception to go back to the following instruction just like you would with a return from a normal function call. So there's lots of system calls on Linux and most modern operating systems. So these are like sort of examples of sort of the very essential ones to give you an idea. So mmap and break are system calls which allocate memory. They allocate memory in slightly different ways. But malloc is going to somehow use one of these to actually get memory from the operating system to actually change what the address space looks like and expand the heap. If we want to create new processes, we definitely need to ask the OS to do that, because we can't choose what the OS is going to do when it gets a timer interrupt to start running something new. So there's system calls for that. So fork is the system call which creates a new process on Linux. And execve is a system call, which is very confusing, that takes the current process and replaces it with a different program. So it loads a different program into the current process. And we mentioned XSet already. And there's also, for example, those core system calls on Linux are to open, read, and write files, called open, read, and write. And I note that files on Linux doesn't just mean files on disk. It also means like terminals, you know, and screens and I/O devices also count as files. So it's all one interface. These are all the system calls you use to do most types of I/O, no matter whether it's to disk or to the screen. So we mentioned that system calls are a way to get at things that you need kernel mode. But to make sure that this actually doesn't just break kernel mode, we need to have the operating system make sure do things right. And the key idea here to make sure that we actually, you know, give programs access to these things like allocating memory that need kernel mode to change the address space without letting programs just write to all other programs' memory, is that system calls are going to be the only way, exceptions in general, and system calls for requesting services are the only way to access kernel mode. There's no other way for a user program to get into kernel mode. And this means that the operating system, by controlling what's in the exception table, can control what it is possible for user programs to do that requires kernel mode. So the operating system is responsible for setting up that exception table and writing all those exception handlers really, really, really carefully to make sure that there's nothing bad the program can do. And this turns out to be extremely difficult and something which has often had mistakes made. And even the simple parts are not intuitive. So for example, one thing you do when you write normal functions is you put things on the stack. But let's say I'm writing a program and I do this. I say, hey, I know where the OS keeps something important I want to change. I'm just going to set my stack pointer to that. Then the operating system runs a push instruction in its exception handler, which is running in kernel mode and can write to important OS addresses. And that would be a problem. So one thing that exception handlers written by the OS need to do just to guarantee that user programs doing this doesn't cause a problem is they need to use their own stack. They need to change what the stack is. And it turns out there's some processor support to help out with this. This is very important, not because it wouldn't work if the user programs cooperated, but because they might not. So in addition to needing your own stack, you need to check all the inputs very carefully. So if you see our example of a write system call, we passed a pointer to a string that the operating system needs to read. If we, instead of passing a pointer to a string in our memory, passed a pointer to a string in the operating system's memory, it's responsible for knowing not to send that to the screen and let us read the operating system's memory. Because that might be, for example, the value of a register in some other program that the OS saved that we're not supposed to have access to. That might be from another user, like might be another student's text they were typing. And the operating system is responsible when it implements system calls for doing the checks to make sure that doesn't happen. So this is something you'll learn more about if you take an operating systems course, but you should be aware that this is the mechanism we have. So this is sufficient, but it requires a lot of care by the OS to actually guarantee that we actually protect user programs from each other and protect the operating system from user programs doing malicious things. So we mentioned sort of our protection faults, our timer interrupts, and our traps, our system calls. And we didn't really mention like how I/O actually works. So let's look at an example of what's going to happen when we read keyboard input. How does that actually end up working? How many exceptions are involved here? So if we have a program, I call fgets, read some line, and then print it out. So how many exceptions are going to happen? Would you expect to happen during the execution of this program? And fgets is going to use one read system call, let's say. So who thinks the answer is more than one? Greater than one? Greater than two? Exactly two? No. No guesses. Who doesn't has no idea? How many? Okay. Most people. So let's start off with the simple case. So fgets, I tell you, uses a read system call. So is a system call an exception? People are nodding. Yes. So there's at least one. So in the best case, maybe we somehow get the input right away from the read system call. That seems unlikely. It seems more likely that we're going to have to wait. That we're going to make a read system call, and I'm not going to type at my keyboard right. I will have already typed something at my keyboard, and we're going to have to wait for me to type something. And while that happens, the operating system is probably going to run something else. There's not anything more for this program to do while the operating system is doing that read on its behalf. So the most likely scenario is that we have this trap, this read system call, and then some other programs run, and then we have an interrupt. That was the type of exception, which includes I/O, for the actual read from the keyboard happening. And one of those interrupts is going to actually make our input be ready, and that's going to actually trigger the read input to start running again. So there's at least two exceptions in this case. Can anyone make a case for a third one? Go back to this program. So what's going to happen when I exit main? What do you expect to happen when your program leaves main? Does it keep running? So you're shaking your head. So if it stops running, how does that happen? So the only way for it to stop running is the operating system needs to go start running. So the way that act is going to happen in practice is there's some code the compiler has which runs main, which makes an exit system call after main finishes. So we're going to have at least three exceptions to run this code. And as we'll learn next week, the answer is probably more like five, six to run this program. In addition, something you might have thought is that if we have an interrupt every time I press a key, I probably press multiple keys to give a line of input. So there's probably more exceptions happening for that reason. So that's our timeline. So one thing I'd like to say is that I've shown you the assembly code for using system calls, but there are library functions that wrap system calls. So typically, you'll call a function called open rather than directly inserting a syscall instruction in your program. And this function will, you know, set up the RAX register to have the system call number. And also, the convention is on Linux that it will process the return value to handle errors and put them in a special variable called ErrorNum. And this is just a convenience thing. You could write the assembly yourself, but there are lots of programs which have lots of functions which have man pages which are basically look like this. That they just set a system call number, make a system call, and process the error number if there's an error number. And that's all I have for today.